kind of this kind of momentary historical compromise that now is being clawed back. And I guess austerity is the latest incarnation, at least of the language, of that rollback.
Right. Austerity and impoverishment and oppression, those were the normal conditions of capitalism in the United States all through the 1800s and the early 1900s and right up until the late part of the 20th century, with 80s or so as a turnaround. And you get more and more of it today. Today you have students graduating college with $75,000 debts, you know. You have the same rollback going on, of course, now in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
They don't owe the working class anything anymore. They just started rolling them back. And Richard Pipes, of all people, I mean, a conservative like him, I'll give him credit. He didn't suppress the study, but he did the study of all the former communist countries. You know how things are. And it came out overwhelmingly, people saying it was better under communism.
Mm-hmm.
Better under communism, you know. The farmers would say it was better. We got subsidies. We could sell our stuff and this and that. And students, it was better for them. It was better for public transportation was better. The healthcare system was more equitable, more accessible. And you can go on. So that's what they're really, the whole game is really a class struggle game. That's what it is.
Yeah. If I could go back to something you mentioned very briefly before, was just how war is now being like tied in with austerity. You see, like, you know, with austerity now, you see increased rise of interventions of like basically the American military and Western military forces abroad. And increased violence around the world, and increased interventions and these kind of things. So how does that really, imperialism, tie in with austerity?
Well, imperialism, the empire feeds off the republic. I mean, where does an empire get its operational wealth from? From the republic, from the people. You got to tax the American public. How do you get to tax them, and so that you have a federal budget every year in which 52% is for military purposes? Right there, that's just 52% off the top, and not to mention a lot of other things, military pensions, all sorts of other stuff. But so the way you do that is you convince your public that this is for their safety. We have to control the world, or the world will devour us. And so we've been seeing it again and again and again. Imperialism is an extension, an outgrow of capitalism, but it's also a way of making the world safe for the plutocracy. That's really its great goal. And to provide places for investment and further profit at greater margins than before.
Yeah, and I guess this kind of goes into the whole profit pathology, right? Because, I mean, I think you even said in one of your talks, you know, the whole idea that capitalism can never stay home. Like, it has to keep expanding. And if it doesn't expand, I mean, basically it collapses, right? So, I mean, like imperialism and capitalism, I guess, go hand in hand with regard to that.
It's a mad system. That's why I said pathology. I mean, yeah, it is a mad system. It's designed to pay workers as little as possible and yet hope that there'll be many workers with lots of spending power to pick up all these commodities and services that I'm creating with these underpaid workers, you know. And my hope is that some other owner will give their workers enough money so they'll have the money to buy up the goods and services that my underpaid workers are creating. But the other owners have the same idea, and they too underpay their workers. And so there's a chronic overproduction. There's a chronic underconsumption. Even though we have a big consumer society, there's all sorts of crap that you got more things, you know, consumer items and gizmos and and even in the area of food, where the food is, some of the fast food stuff is uneatable, but there it is, and expensive and cheap in some cases. But so imperialism is the outgrowth of capitalism. War brings a false prosperity, you know. Mm-hmm. And socialism, what imperialism is socialism coming to the rescue again. Capitalism is always rescued by the government. I mean, the number of programs of research and development in all sorts of areas, the railroad industry, the mining industry, the steel industry, the airline industry, the internet industry, and all these things are publicly owned. That plutocratic class that constantly denounces the government, constantly scolds the American people, as you're saying, austerity, stop looking for a handout from the government, stop running off to the government with silly, wasteful things like Social Security and Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And all. If I didn't have those, I'd be out on the street right now myself, I'm telling No, it's not funny.
So, well, I mean, there's a lot of people, right? Like, who face that.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said before, the irony is, of course, that same plutocracy goes to the government, I mean, owns the government, I mean, gets more subsidies,
mm-hmm.
agribusiness, trillions of dollars in subsidies, pharmaceuticals, trillions, the medicine industry, the... And now with Obamacare, you've got the health insurance industry
mm-hmm.
piping up their racket. It's given people more services, but it has been but these guys get their shakedown before we ever see any services.
Yeah, and I guess this is the real face of the capitalist state, right? The state serving the capitalist class, like these the Fortune 500. I guess you could say serving their interests and not the interests of the people. Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. We're playing Back in the USSR's interview with Michael Parenti on the issue of austerity. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Yeah. It ends up serving their interests. They'll take any good program or need that's needed. They'll argue against it. They'll denounce it. But then they'll put through a version of it where they end up walking away with enormous profits.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't think you have to engage in a big ideological struggle against the capitalists or imperialists, at least with people when trying to convince them. What I did in this book, Profit Pathology, is I suggested a very simple empirical approach to, rather than an ideological struggle or grand isms. You know, my superism against your superism or whatever, and just do empirical choices. Just look at things. I say this. I say, let's have socialism wherever socialism works better than capitalism. Well, we've been taught that socialism is a flop and it doesn't work, and that's that. But, you know, public utilities work much better than private utilities. The rates are cheaper. The service is better. You don't have CEOs who are making $2, $3, $4 million a year as a CEO of the utility. You don't have all the kickbacks and whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
We have a private utility here in California, PG&E, which brought death to users in San Bruno, where people in San Bruno were smelling gas and complaining and saying there's a gas leak somewhere here, and the company didn't. The company is too busy scooping up profits for itself, and it blew up, and 8 people were killed, and another 35 were seriously hurt, and about 40 or 50 houses. If you had seen the photos, I don't know if you ever got them there. They were staggering. These houses were just blown right off their foundations, just nothing there, torn apart like a tornado or something. So public utilities are better. The rates are lower. Your surplus doesn't go to stockholders to enrich them. Your surplus goes into the public budget, and that helps the taxpayers a little, you know. Let's look at schools. Public schools, public universities are better than private ones. The idea that we now have more and more private for-profit universities, for-profit. The school admits that it creates this university to make profits for its shareholders, not for education. Well, again, it would be a lot cheaper if you just have a public university, that you don't have to be producing large amounts of wealth for the shareholders. All the money goes back into the school. How about public medicine, public health care, public hospitals? Mm-hmm. They're better. They're better. And the things that public transportation is so much more efficient, so much better for the environment and the like. Public transportation here carts more people than the congestion and slaughter of cars does. So what do we do for capitalism? Maybe restaurants restaurants we can say it's better that the restaurant is owned by mom and pop, and they really have the little touch to it than having the state. Judging from my experience with restaurants in socialist countries, I might lean in that direction. So what I'm saying is, instead of getting into an isms fight, let's just go with social function by social function and say, well, what's been better? What's been better? Tell us, really.
Yeah, like just kind of bring it down to like that empirical level, right? I mean, I have a similar story, actually. I mean, you were telling the story about what happened in California where, like, you know, those houses were blown away.
Yeah.
Once again, there's a result of that private company, and the cutbacks and all this kind of stuff. A similar thing happened in Ontario in the 1990s. In this case, it had to do with the privatization of water systems. And, this is something that definitely should be in the public domain, needless to say.
Now, if there's an accident with a public system...
Yeah, this was
never an end to it, and you say, you see, these systems don't, it's not good, it doesn't work, and you should give it to a private company.
Yeah.
That's more, and they immediately elevate it into an ism thing, and so forth.
Yeah.
But it's not true when it happens to them, when you got the BP blowing up oil floats and destroying half of New Orleans and all that, they just say, "Oh, that was an accident."
Yeah,
they don't raise the question of, "Is this the way capitalism operates?" Well, this is terrible. This is life threatening. This is destroying our environment and our city and our people. They don't say that. They just say, "Well, there's been an accident. We got to clean it up." Oh.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cleanup goes to socialism.
Oh, right, yeah.
Also, and they have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Like the public has to pay the cost every time, right? I mean, in the Ontario case, it was a town called Walkerton.
Yes.
And basically this place, they had privatized the water system. And because
it was
the
private one, you said, Siegfried, I didn't hear you.
Yeah, they privatized the water system there.
Oh.
And basically what ended up happening is it got contaminated by E. coli lack of oversight and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
About like 8 people ended up dead, like hundreds more got sick, and most of the people who died were kids, right?
Oh my God.
So like this kind of thing like happened. There was a big scandal back in like 1995.
Did they put it under public ownership again, or it's still privately owned?
Well, I mean, these days it's like kind of more of like a public-private kind of partnership or whatever it is they call it. I mean, basically it's like maybe some increased oversight, but it's mostly like in the private domain still.
Yeah.
And there's like a lot of privatization going on now. I know the hydro system's about to get privatized and sold off right up here. It's a big thing. I mean, some people are being mobilized around it right now. Because that was the next thing I was actually going to ask you about. Like, how are people fighting back against these kind of policies, which are very, very anti-worker, anti-public in general?
Well, they get angry about certain things. You know, PG&E, the company I was telling you about, they were given $42 million. Again, socialism supporting capitalism. Gave them money to rebuild all various pipelines that had problems, were brittle, leaking, or chipping, or showing signs of being ready to blow up or something.
Mm-hmm.
They did all that, but it didn't really you know, it wasn't used. It wasn't used for those purposes. PG&E took that money and waged a campaign, a statewide referendum, to prohibit any kind of public utilities in the state of California. They spent millions. They spent millions of dollars on this campaign, and miracle of miracles, they lost anyway. The people did not want to hand over all the utilities to the private profiteers. And well, I deal with these things in my book. Some of those things, and I also talk about in my book, Private Pathology and Other Indecencies. I also talk about how small little things, or you talk about austerity. How about Holocaust? How about extermination? 12 to 18 million native indigenous peoples in North America, who and 500 language groups were all destroyed from what, 1600 to 1890, almost three centuries. Just destruction to take an immense fortune from them, an immense fortune of mineral deposits, of water, forests, lands, topsoil. I mean, a huge enriched continent taken over, stolen, and killing the people, exterminating the people who are on the land, you know. And that's another thing. And then the immense capital accumulation from slavery, which people don't usually talk about, but you know, cotton was probably the greatest value production of any. I mean, more than coal, more than iron, more than just about anything else for quite a while. It was, and again, that was on the labor of African slaves, people who were brought in here and enslaved in terrible ways. This is the so-called primitive accumulation, indeed primitive, I would say, murderously primitive. And I guess the story I'm saying is, the system is an amazing system of horrors and abuses and murder and destruction and holocausts, and it's all sort of normal. The crises of capitalism, just about every few years, there's a crisis, there's a panic, there's a drop, there's recessions, and it's still going on to this very day. There's still a recession going on right now.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say, like, people are increasingly waking up to the reality of the system here?
I don't know. There certainly are many who are just as stupid and blind to it and bought into it as ever. They watch Fox News and they get roped in. But there are people who are seeing. Look at the protests of the Occupy movement. That was very unusual for the U.S. anyway. Probably better in Canada. I think ideologically somewhat more developed in Canada than they are in the United States. Although there could be plenty of work done there too, and even in Europe, I think the Europeans were so far ahead and sophisticated. The more I spoke in Europe and went, I realized, my gosh, they got some of the wool has been pulled over their eyes too in some instances, you know. It's just got a lot. There's just an awful that you know where the wake up was with the Occupy movement. It was just that one little phrase, 1% versus 99%.
Right.
So suddenly the great divide that you and I and others have been trying to get across and say, look, there's a great divide here, financially, ideologically, anyway. And of course, and then developing it a little more, and you say, wait, it's not 1%. 1% of the American population is 3 million people. No, they're not super rich. You can be up there in the top 3 million with $200,000 a year, and you're up in that bracket almost. This is like a fraction of 1%. You know, it's a hundredth of 1%. That the super rich have never been more unequal among themselves than they are today. And in other words, in America, in any case, we still don't even realize, we don't know how rich the super rich really are. We look at these homes up on the hill here in Berkeley, and they go for $2 million, and they're very nice homes indeed. I would never be able to afford such a place, but that's not rich, you know. That could be a professor with tenure and some smart investments could probably float a house like that or something. The very rich are people who live in places where you don't see their front yards that easily, because there's a gate and there's a great estate and there's a special pad for a helicopter or a private plane, and they live really very different.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, there certainly has been people waking up, though. I mean, like, I've been quite impressed by the campaigns for raising the minimum wage, which are, like, in a lot of U.S. cities now, and a lot of, like, low-wage workers, like, from McDonald's even, like, who, you know, most people wouldn't even see them going out on strike, but they're going out on strike. And there's, like, been quite a few actions. Like, it seems like a lot of places, and even in Ontario now, like, we're starting to see, you know, raise the minimum wage to $15. Like, that's becoming a pretty big thing now.
Yes, and as I say, it gets back to that madness and that contradiction of not paying the people who you need as customers. You know?
It's true, you know. And another thing, of course, like Indigenous peoples. I mean, we talked about that before. All the things that they've suffered at the hands of, like, you know, they say primitive accumulation, and they're increasingly politically active. You know, like they. You might have even seen the picture from this when I was in Washington D.C. A few months ago, right? And, like, you know, they raised the Mohawk flag outside the White House, and these were people who were coming down in support of Ecuadorian activists who were campaigning against Chevron, you know, what it's done to the Ecuadorian rainforest.
Yeah.
You know, and the devastation that it's caused down there, right? So, I mean, you see these – I mean, that was some very real international solidarity there, and you also had, like, the Indigenous dynamic in there as well, and it was very amazing to be a part of that.
And sometimes it does reach a point where the oppression can be so extreme that the people who are oppressed have no choice but to fight back. And I mean, when you think of it, who the hell can live on $7 an hour? I mean,
it's true.
At least in this country, the way prices are, the prices are still going up. You know, gas went down, big deal. Well, that's something, but it's really a shame. It's a shame. It's an insult. It's an offense to people's humanity. It is. So that's what the book is about. I wrote a lot of stuff in there, and it's only 150 pages. But I sort of had fun packing it in. I shouldn't say have fun. Sometimes it was with a painful grimace, but that's the way it goes.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is some pretty serious stuff we're talking about here, right?
Yes, indeed. Off the record, we've done a half hour. Can we? Should we call it quits?
Yeah, we can wrap it up, or if you want to talk some more, I mean, you can. You know, either way.
My voice is going, and I don't know.
Yeah, well, you know, we can. We can definitely we can definitely end it here, no problem. But yeah, I mean. This book, once again, like, sounds very interesting. I know I'm going to try to read it as soon as I can. And this is Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies, which I think you who publishes that?
It's Rutledge and Paradigm Publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. And once again, like, your website is michaelparenti.org.
That's correct.
And so if people want to, like, read more of your articles or find out about more of your books, you know, just they can go and check that out. Well,
yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I guess probably what we should end on is Antonio Gramsci's quote. You know, just of all we've talked about, you know, we must have a pessimism of the mind, but an optimism of the will.
Right.
Right. I know you've said that many times, and I know I've certainly tried to take that one to heart. You know, given what we're up against, but what these struggles that we have to basically face, what we have to go through. Very important. All right. So, Michael Parenti, thank you very much for joining us today on Back in the USSR. I really appreciate this.
Thank you, Siegfried. Thank you.
Okay. I'll talk to you soon. All right?
Right. Sure.
Thanks. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So greedy, 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 greedy. So greedy, 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 greedy. Now they say they kept a tiger in my hometown, brings jewels and crowns, picks you up off the ground. But the Celtic tiger does two things. It brings you good luck, or it eats you up for supper. It's the tale of two cities on the Shamrock Shore. Please, sir, can I have some more? If you hear the tiger roar, run for the door, 'cause if you are poor, you'll be eaten for sure. And that's how we know the poor have more taste than the rich. And that's how we know the poor have better taste than the rich.
Oh, I am your gorgeous
sea. Hear the Celtic tiger roar it one more. Celtic tiger roar it one more. The fastest growing inflation rate in the world. The cost of a rundown house is absurd. This is the dandy age for a low income wage. Ask anyone who's locked in a cage. A couple with kids can't afford a place to live. Even if they have a good job, we're being robbed by the builders and the fat cat government elite. Green, and they don't even need for a thing. It's a sin, but it's the nature of the beast. You better go and find a priest and confess, because your greed is gonna leave you soulless.
Hear
the Celtic tiger roar it one more. I got roar and one more. Where we gonna live? What we gonna do? We'll have to move in with the woman in the shoe. They're driving us onto the streets, while the fat cat in government cheats and always gets away with his crime. A kid steals a jacket and does time. Just look at the world around you. Tell me, why is there so much need? Because of greed. Because of greed. So greedy, 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 greedy. So greedy, 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 greedy. So greedy, 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 greedy. So greedy.
I got roar, I want more. I am
the Celtic tiger roar, I want more.
And you shall not have any other god but me. I am your god, you see. And you shall not have any other god but me. Any other god but me. Any other god but me.
Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
Hi, I'm Sabelle. I am on CFRU 93.3 FM, and you can be too.
Hi, my name is Peter, and I volunteer at CFRU because it's a space that really encourages creativity and expressing yourself.
My name is Stacy. I love discovering music that sounds good to me. All kinds of music.
I love the people, I love the atmosphere, and everyone loves radio, and you can tell.
If you love radio and would like to get involved, volunteer at CFRU. No previous experience is required, and we provide all the training. Check out our website at cfru.ca or call Christopher at 519-824-4120. Extension 58341, or email volunteer@cfru.ca.
Volunteering at CFRU breeds minds, breeds culture. So come on down.
Êtes-vous francophone ou francophile?
CFRU is looking for French-speaking volunteers to start or contribute to French language programming on the station.
Le genre du programme est à vous. Que ce soit sur les actualités, la justice sociale ou les arts, la meilleure émission sera sur un sujet dont vous êtes passionné. Nous offrons la formation gratuite en technologie et production des médias.
Envoyez un message avec votre nom et coordonnées à Brian par courriel à polylingual@commercialcfru.ca pour devenir bénévole dans cette nouvelle radio collective. Apportez votre voix à CFRU 93.3 FM, la radio communautaire de Guelph.
Hey Griffins, my name is Tessa and I'm here on behalf of the Wellness Education Center and Guelph Center for Organic Farming. I'm here to let you all know that you no longer have to leave the campus to buy your fruit and veggies. An organic farmers market has come back to the University of Guelph campus. Brought to you by the Wellness Education Center and Guelph Center for Organic Farming, this market gives the University of Guelph students, staff, and faculty the opportunity to buy fresh local produce grown by our very own Griffins. We have everything from carrots, cabbage, tomatoes, and peppers to fresh herbs and garlic. We also have complimentary recipes available to make cooking a little easier. Need a pumpkin to decorate for Halloween? We've got your back. Not sure what a bitter melon is? Come by the market to find out. The market will be located across from the Richards Building, close to Bob's Dogs, a physically accessible location, every Thursday afternoon from 3 to 6 p.m. until mid-November. Hope to see you there.
Now then you got about 5 centuries of imperialism coming along. And imperialism was when the powers of Western Europe began to expropriate the land, labor, and wealth of Eastern Europe. That was the first area of expansion and exploitation that they went into. And the second was the New World. And then having developed all the superior firepower and mobility and transportation, they went then into Africa and Asia and further into Latin America. And with this imperialism, which is a history that really, to read the history of modern imperialism, as it's still going on today, to read that history is really to read a history of a succession of the most horrendous, horrible atrocities that one can imagine. Now, when the ruling classes of these imperialist nations plundered and exploited the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the markets of other people, when they enslaved their labor, when they burned their villages, when they destroyed their industries and their crafts and their mines and their herds and their crops, when they raped them and murdered them and mutilated them, when they did all that sort of thing, and they worked them to death in the latifundios and the plantations and in the mines, then theories had to come along to justify what you were doing. And the theories about these lesser races proliferated. These lesser races were animals. They were cruel savages. They were incapable of self-governance. They were like pathetic, helpless children. They'd been around living in peace for, 5,000 years before you came along, but suddenly now they wouldn't be able to get along without us. They were devoid of the normal sensibilities that one might expect from a person in civilized societies. Again, not an anachronistic attitude. In my own lifetime, the lifetime of most of you, the adult lifetime of most of you, General Westmoreland, you remember him? Vietnam, your average Asian, the Asian doesn't place the same importance on life we Americans do. That's your average Asian. And with the massive bombings and saturation bombings, a war of horror and attrition and mass slaughter, he was pointing out that indeed one of those two protagonists did not place the same value on life as the other, but he had it mixed up, that's all. And with imperialism, there came in the 19th century the class-based, racist, patriarchal theories about human nature, known as science. Science came along and rushed in there with measurements of skulls and brain sizes. Whites were superior to blacks, males were superior to women, men of substance were superior to men of poverty. Race, gender, and class again. 19th century science gave us a great scientist, by the way, who took human beings out of the medieval metaphysical scheme of things and made them part of the natural order of things. And in a sense, it was a very revolutionary and very progressive thing that he did, a very great contribution, Charles Darwin. But a closer reading of some of the other things Darwin said in his Descent of Man, for instance, definitely shows him to be a product of 19th century science, which in turn is a product of 19th century imperialism and capitalism and upper-class white male Europeans. Darwin, quote, "Man is more courageous, pugnacious, and energetic than woman, and has a more inventive genius." This is the best scientific mind of the 19th century in England, British Royal Society. "Men are superior in every activity requiring deep thought, reason, or imagination." Except imagination about women, I guess. "Men vastly excel in the sciences, philosophy, history, the arts, poetry, painting, and sculpture." Ready? Sisters, are you ready? Women excel in tenderness, unselfishness, intuition, imitation, and other qualities that are characteristic of the lesser races. Darwin argued, in effect, that women are less evolved biologically, evolutionarily. For Darwin, culture doesn't explain anything. By the way, it's true of most of these people. Cultural differences are the thing that needs to be explained. And these differences are explained as being grounded in biological development in human natures in the process of natural selection. In the Descent of Man, or natural selection, or both, combination of both, biological, innate biological structures and natural selection and development of those biological developments in natural selection. Let's turn to what Darwin had to say about races. Now, we're talking right 1880. This is when England is building an empire upon which the sun never sets. At the time Darwin is saying this, the Brits are killing a variety of people from Ceylon to India to Malaysia to God knows where's Africa, or working them to death. Darwin thought that the sense of smell was more highly developed in darker races, as in animals, than in white civilized peoples. The same, by the way, with other physiological characteristics. The rudimentary ear lobule, the larger wisdom teeth, the more pronounced conical form of the canine teeth, and certain bone structures, all supposedly common to the darker races, and all, therefore, more proximate to animal physiology, testify to their less advanced evolutionary development. By the way, none of that's true. In case you want to go checking teeth. Here's Darwin talking. "Given, quote, the hideous ornaments and the equally hideous music admired by most savages," unquote, Darwin concluded that their aesthetic faculty was less developed than that of birds. I mean, what impresses you is the total oblivion, the total ignorance of the brutalities of imperialism, the total ignorance of the adverse effects on the health and survival of native peoples that imperialism had when they came into exposure to European diseases, the deracination, the mistreatment, the deaths. Darwin looks at this. He discusses some particular tribe that dies out. I think it was a tribe in the American Southwest. Says they died out. He concluded that the extinction of these tribes when they came in contact with whites was evidence of their lesser biological capacity, their immunity systems, their capacities, and such. Nothing having to do with starvation, nothing having to do with injecting smallpox into blankets and then selling them to the Indians, nothing having to do with the Gatling gun and the Maxim gun and the mass murder. They die out because they're lesser. Savages snarled more often and had less control of their fear reactions and sphincter muscles than did Europeans, Darwin said. Now, how did he suppose he found that out? And what did he do to study that one? I don't know. It's not the kind of research I'd want to do. Thus, they were more like monkeys and dogs in that respect. That's from The Descent of Man. Civilized males were less emotive than savages and less inclined to weep. Now, even among civilized males, there were ethnic and evolutionary differences, by the way. Englishmen rarely cried or shrugged their shoulders energetically, while Frenchmen and Italians were given to such less advanced displays. Why the absence of shrugging of shoulders is seen as an evolutionary gain is not clear to me. I don't understand. You see, but you're getting this very interesting convolution. You're getting the trait of what is assumed to be the more evolved person as evidence of that evolution. So on the one hand, right, that Englishman manifests these traits. Therefore, these traits must be the more evolved traits. He has these more evolved traits, therefore he is more evolved. And the thing just kind of self-fulfills itself. Darwin, by the way, is rather ignorant of the so-called lesser peoples. I mean, if you ever want to, he mentioned the Italians, if you ever wanted to see a people, southern Italian peasants, who I'm sure he would feel very uncomfortable being in the same room with, if you ever wanted to see a people, having come from that stock myself, all my grandparents, both sides, if you want to see a people who had a rigorous idea of social strictures and interpersonal diplomacy and what was proper and what was hospitality and what you said and what you didn't say and how you presented this and didn't present that. Or if you go to any savage society, so-called savage, or primitive peoples, native peoples, indigenous peoples, anywhere, whether it be American Indians or Melanesians, again, the same thing. Elaborate codes, certainly as elaborate, as advanced, as subtle, as nuanced as anything you could find in upper-class English society. Maybe not quite as stuffy, but certainly they were there. The fact that he was ignorant of them, the fact that he never saw or talked to one of these people, except to glance at them from the side of his boat, doesn't mean that it didn't exist, you see. And by the way, there was a very interesting thing that happened in the British Royal Society, where a debate broke out between Darwin and his closest collaborator, Wallace, where Wallace got up and suddenly started making very strange statements, because they had a problem. The problem was, if the human brain is a manifestation of the level of evolution, why is the savage brain not vastly small? Why is it roughly the same or so large as the white British European brain? They had these gradations. Thomas Huxley was another one who believed it. He said the most highly evolved are the Europeans. The most highly evolved of the Europeans are the upper class. The most highly evolved of them are the upper class Englishmen. The most highly evolved of them are the members of our British Royal Society. Me. Why could the world be more like me? Right? Huxley, with all the characteristic modesty of his class, decided it had that hierarchy. That was Darwin's hierarchy, too. But they had this problem. If these savages had such good brains, why weren't they more evolved? And Wallace got up and he says, you know, I don't think this is a problem, because I think they are evolved. And the thing about Wallace is he had lived in Melanesia for about 2 years. He says, I've lived with these people, and I find among them people who have a range of intelligence and subtlety and imagination and gift and craft and science within the confines of their material culture and all, which the best among them could compare favorably with members of our British Royal Society. And there was a gasp, of course. That was like saying, down with the Queen or something. And that was the difference between Wallace and, on one hand, and Huxley and Darwin on the other.
And I would call all the world's water traitor, for the way her body brought the traitors of fur, of flesh, of Black Hills gold, holding butterfly nets wove of heartstrings so cold they were able to freeze and then capture my nation's breezes, kidnap the Blackfoot net peel, whitewash, replaced with a half-scalped, war-painted Jesus, a strangled, slit-throat Caesar, so unable to say, et tu, Brute, he simply mouthed the letters O and K. And as today's stray bullets pull stars from the sky, through bubble-wrapped newborn darkness I see that midnight is them and the noon is me. But now bright minds' lights have ruined the moon like the white's ruined wounded knee. They pruned our freedom, clip-snip, quick-flip, bonsai, treedom. And now we unneeded like weeds in the Garden of Eden. But me, I ain't never seen a field of dandelions trying to grow into roses. God knows Columbus needed no Moses to split the sea of my red people. He knew enough to just trust in the strength of the steeple, the breadth and length of cathedrals, God's gospel-glossed needles, force-feeding canatas, pre-bleeding, crimson Indian summer evenings, leaving me grieving that even as we speak our spoken words, these thieves are still weaving history through tree trunks, searching for reasons to clear-cut the psyche. I think we all know that if Mikey didn't like his bowl of life, they would have let him starve. And still we wonder at the marvels of our carbon nation, segra, degra, congregation, and still the throngs they hasten to sing songs of race and reformation, once sung by the lungs of long-dead masons. So if here's the place, and now's the time, you run your race while I fast and pray for mine, and hunger for the days when I can release the image of my people, proud and free from the collective walls of imagination. But right now, North America's just a fucked up fancy restaurant, and I'm looking forward to the day when I can't get a reservation.
With the emergence of capitalism, class power and privilege also were justified as manifestations of human nature. People are selfish. Some are go-getters, others are laggards. The system rewards and encourages the creative and the inventive and punishes the slothful and parasitic. But if it's so natural, and it's so inevitable, why were the laws rewritten during the 19th century to protect and to arm the privileges of finance capital and industrial capital? I mean, if it was a natural thing that would just play itself out in the free market, why did you need the state? Why did you need to set up eminent domain laws, which were used to wipe out small property owners to the advantage of canal and railroad speculators? Or, as is done today, eminent domain still used to wipe out small property owners to make way for big developers and corporate investors who build their office buildings and shopping malls. Why were labor laws written to deprive workers of any means of self-protection? If it was all natural, everybody in their place, just as Plato said, the carpenter doing his carpentry, why did you need a law that made it a crime for the carpenter to talk to another carpenter and join together to try to better their lives? Why were gun thugs needed and sheriffs and Pinkerton detectives and company goons and state militia and the U.S. Army used to keep people down? These people who were naturally in their place in this natural system that's part of the natural outgrowth, the ordinary diurnal activity of human nature every day. This civilization built on the gun and the sword and the rope and the whip, this is all perfectly natural, unforced, uncoerced. If it was so uncoerced, why is it a history of the most artificial coercive powers of the state, used repeatedly to give the wealthy every advantage and every predominance, as it's still being used to this day, right now, as we sit here and talk? If it's so natural, then why do they need death squads in El Salvador? If it's so natural to defend that imperialism and defend that natural system of capitalism, then why are people risking their lives against it in many parts of the world? Why use every subterfuge to keep the mass of people down, keep them divided, keep them disfranchised, if they're such laggards and if they're so uninterested in self-betterment? No, no, they're supposed to be interested in self-betterment. They're supposed to be interested in individual, selfish betterment. I want to better myself. I want to get ahead. Get ahead of what? Get ahead of the others. It's when they do collective self-betterment. It's when they begin to see that their self-interest is an interest of a whole social formation. That's when it becomes unnatural. And that's when we've got to go in there on that.
Flow combat, B, I born that, beaches thorn that, reformat the masses, I'm redrafting the battle maps at top of task list, I build a classic boom bap blast, bazooka rap shit, I'm sending heads into backspin, attack with wind at the back, plus vernaculars to dig it back my facts, packed with the stat charts and graphs, I got passion, burn mics up to ashes, I make fascists, crapped in pantses, stanzas, cure culture. Cultural cancer, I got tunes that move you to dance, burn flags, anthem, throw a tantrum, getting out of hand with these random acting tactics against the axis, my word act like nominally got, rhymingly packed, punch, crash the fun by metric tons, and plus my math, distribute cash among the classes, take from the thieving greedy bastard, give back like church has to get past, collapse structure, fuck facades, I destruct the support beams and bars, wrecking ball large, resistance, subversive diction, flip the shit just like a brick throw, dethrone kings, bring the trees on, my tone rock like Gibraltar pop, hip hop hotter than a rocket shot, I'm crime, think, thought, bring the big talk, teach you to flee from the flock, walk off, switch shit, hit my target, drop like bombs in the form of carpets, I got the target locked on the arch. Pump your fist if you know where we are. That's a rap. Boom bap. Original rap at. Take it back. Boom bap. Boom bap. I'm talking true path, master the craft, the pupil, the prof, keep dropping math. Boom bap, blast the bazooka rap.
Boom bap. Original rap.
Now, in this age of democracy, where everyone is saying they're for democracy, we also hear this litany of capitalism and class ideology. You know, I happened to find myself in a hotel in Antigua once. It was an overnight. It was the most horrible experience I had. The travel agent said, it's okay, go there, it's informal. And I said, well, it's kind of expensive for a little informal hotel. I got there, and it was inhabited by rich American, British, and Canadian people. And I had dinner sitting at a table with these people, and it was rather fascinating because everybody sitting was white and rich. The women were talking about where they bought their gold. So we go to South Africa to buy our gold, saying things like that. It was really great. This was back in 1978, 9, around there. And the men were talking about investment opportunities and this place or that place and all that. And all of them were sitting, and they were white. And they got onto one of their favorite subjects, which white, rich, exploited people talk about, which is how lazy the poorer people are, you know. And I noticed everyone who was standing was black. The ones who were cooking the food, bringing the food, serving the food, and they were all black. Those were the lazy ones were black. And there were some people at those tables that never worked a day in their lives who were making statements. Well, you can imagine me choking on my food. But it's really interesting, the capacity for selective perception about what human beings are, the ability to have your class ideology serve and predefine your reality. I saw a documentary film once on Nicaragua, and there was an interview, a pre-revolutionary, before the Sandinista Revolution, an interview of a group of very well-to-do Nicaraguan men and women sitting on a veranda, dressed to the nines, with their drinks, and the men of their haunches and their dark glasses and all that, and the women were there with all the layers of jewelry and everything else, and the coiffured hair, and they're all sitting there. I mean, on them, on their backs, they had enough to feed a whole Nicaraguan village for the better part of a year, I would wager. And they're sitting there, and they were doing that favorite sport when the rich get together, talking about what is so wrong with the poor. Why can't they just not be the way they are? They're just something. And then finally, one of them hadn't done any talking. This guy says, what the poor need is education. I said, hey, the liberal, here he comes. Thank God, there's one saying that. And I perk up a little, you know. The snarl begins to leave my face. And I get kind of my little hopeful Oliver Twist look on my face. And I look at him, and he says, the poor need education. I still remember his gesture. They need education in how to be human beings. And I go, the capacity for selective perception in regard to class, race, and gender realities is limitless. Reality is a secondary consideration or no consideration at all. Reality can be stood on its head. That seems to be a manifestation of human nature, or a certain kind anyway, of certain people in certain social situations.
¿Por qué preguntarnos cómo le vamos a hacer si nos pintan como unos huevones?